PolitiFact is out with its annual Lie of the Year, and the winner is a campaign that smeared survivors of a deadly mass shooting. Also, we'll get a rundown of PolitiFact's top 10 most popular fact checks of 2018 in California. Massive wildfires in California are destroying homes and businesses at a rate that's creating a shortage of qualified contractors. We'll hear from the head of the state's Building Industry Association. And how do you get young brains to learn to read? One language expert says it takes some important steps early in childhood beyond just reading exercises. Dr. Kathy Hirsch-Pasek will break down the process. And larger-than-life entertainer Sacramento's Peter Petty joins us with a sneak peek at his weekend holiday show, A Swinging Yuletide Review. I'm Randall White in for Beth Ruyak this week. That's today on Insight. First, here's the news. From Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Randall White in for Beth Ruyak today. Well, 2018 has been a wild year for half-truths and falsities. We have covered many of them on this show, but there are so many more that we couldn't get to throughout the year. Fortunately, Cap Radio's collaboration with PolitiFact keeps us apprised of where the truth lies and where the lies go off the rails. Joining us today by phone is National PolitiFact editor Angie Holland. Angie, welcome to Insight.
Thanks for having me.
And joining us today is PolitiFact California reporter Chris Nichols, who's in studio across the table from me. Chris, good to see you.
Good to be here.
So, Angie, let's start with you. PolitiFact has released its 2018 Lie of the Year. Before we get to the statement or grouping of statements that will wear that title, how does PolitiFact go about narrowing down the candidates throughout the course of the year?
Well, at the end of the year, we look back on all of our fact checks that we've published, and we especially look at the ones that we rated either pants on fire or false. And we ask ourselves, which are the most significant, which really mattered in the political conversation? We select a field of about 10 fact checks that we've done, and then we have a discussion amongst ourselves about which one to select as the lie of the year. It's the falsehood that was most significant in 2018.
And the term lie, used in the designation lie of the year, is a term PolitiFact only uses once a year, and for this very occasion. The truth-o-meter, runs from true on one end to pants on fire at the other. Never is the term lie used. Why is that?
We think that the word lie has a strong connotation of intention. When people say that somebody lied, they usually mean that the person knew what they were saying is wrong. And we try to confine ourselves to fact-checking, whether what they said matches up with reality, but we can't get inside their head and know if they intended to deceive or not.
And Chris, after you report your fact checks, you often hear from listeners or online readers who challenge you on not using the word lie.
I think we're seeing that more and more as journalists in general. And I think, I can certainly understand that frustration. We see false statements that are repeated over and over and over again. And it certainly is frustrating. I think people want a stronger word, but the way I think about it is our job is to go out and verify the facts and to lay those facts out. I hope that people are not coming to us for sort of our guesswork as to what someone intended with a statement, but more, do the facts back up what they said? So, we follow the lead of PolitiFact, and we don't use that term either.
Angie, how much pushback do you get nationally for your organization's work and omitting the word lie?
We get some. People say if we use the word lie more, maybe the politicians would be more truthful. I don't really think that's true. I think that the politicians speak more truthfully when they feel like it's to their political advantage to be more truthful, or when they're held to account by voters. I don't think journalists using the word lie as opposed to misstatement or exaggeration or inaccuracy, I just don't think that that has the power that some people think it does. I think the world's a little bit more of a complicated place just because you call something a lie doesn't mean that everyone's going to say, oh, it's a lie. Now we'll stop saying it. It doesn't work that way.
I guess some people could make the leap after hearing the designation Pants on Fire. Anyone who knows the jingle, it's liar, liar, pants on fire.
That's right. And I've had some interesting conversations where people have confronted me and said, you say you don't use the word lie, but you use the word pants on fire. I will say that our definition of pants on fire is that the statement is inaccurate and makes a ridiculous claim.
How long has PolitiFact been choosing the lie of the year?
This is our 10th year of choosing the lie of the year. Previous years, we've picked claims about health care, lies about the Ebola virus. Last year, it was that the lie that Russia had not meddled in our election when, in fact, they had. So it's been 10 years of lies of the year.
So for the 10th anniversary of it, then, let's get to the 2018 lie of the year. And it has to do with the deadly mass shooting at the high school in Parkland, Florida. Angie, break it down for us.
Yes, our lie of the year was the online smears directed at the Parkland students. So this was a group of claims that tried to discredit the students in the days after the shooting, which was on February 14th. The students started speaking at candlelight vigils and rallies, and they started asking for new laws about guns to prevent school shootings from happening again. And almost at the same moment, these online smears against the students started, saying that they were crisis actors or that they weren't really from Florida or that they had organized before the shooting. It was all conspiracy theories, and it was crazy. It was factually totally inaccurate. But the lies proliferated, and we documented them for several months. They seemed to follow the Parkland students as the students organized marches, met with elected leaders, and asked for change.
So at the time that this mostly online campaign was happening, and you were documenting the individual instances, as an organization, were you saying to yourself, okay, this is an instance that could end up being the lie of the year? And how do you go about that process throughout the year?
I actually did not think about the lie of the year at the time. It was in February. I did think these conspiracy theories are crazy. And we're kind of used to seeing conspiracy theories about elected officials. Hillary Clinton has been the target of many conspiracy theories, like the Pizzagate conspiracy theory. But what startled me this year was to see it directed at young people who were victims of a terrible crime that they had had no part in. And the smears came when the students tried to enter the public square and ask the government for change, which, I mean, at its heart should be the most democratic thing possible. And yes, you can debate gun restrictions. It's certainly up for discussion. People have different opinions on it. But this wasn't about policy. These were smears just directed at these young people, the kids next door. And I think that's what gave it the significance this year.
Angie, was there a close second this year? And if there was, can you let us know what it was?
The readers poll selected something that Donald Trump said. They selected Donald Trump's claim that about the immigration caravan. Now, you probably remember he talked about this during the election. They chose the claim that Democrats were behind the immigration caravan so that they could give illegal immigrants free stuff. So that was what the readers chose. We also on our readers poll, scoring very highly, was Vladimir Putin's claim that the Russians had not meddled in the U.S. election in 2016 or ever. And that was not true.
That's National PolitiFact editor Angie Holland joining us by phone. And here in studio is PolitiFact California reporter Chris Nichols. So Angie just gave us the lie of the year as determined by PolitiFact. But you're here, Chris, to give us the most popular fact checks as determined by readers in California.
That's right. And really, this article is kind of a chance for us here at PolitiFact California to do a little bit of a year in review to see what what our audience was interested in, sort of look at the themes. We noticed, as in past years, our fact checks on immigration were very, very popular. They were very well read. 4 of the top 10 dealt with immigration.
Makes sense in California.
Yes, a huge topic given, the aggressive stance in with the Trump administration towards immigration, undocumented immigration, and California's sort of unique place being a home to more immigrants and undocumented immigrants than any other state.
Did any of the ones you just mentioned have to do with the caravan the way that it did nationally, as Angie just told us?
You know, we did not get into the caravan directly, at least not with any of these most read ones. We just had one a couple weeks ago dealing with the cost of the border shutdown to the caravan, but that was just published, did not make this list. But one that I think is pretty interesting and that we can talk about a little bit is a fact check of a statement by former Los Angeles Mayor Antonio Villaraigosa. He was running for governor at the time he made this statement. And this is back from 2017, but this fact check has remained very popular, has gained a new audience this year, and it deals with undocumented immigrants and crime rates. And he was speaking on MSNBC back in July 2017, and we have sound for that.
I think we all agree that people that commit violent crimes ought to be deported, but going after the undocumented is not a crime strategy. When you look at the fact that according to the National Academy of Sciences, and I think it was November of 2015, the undocumented immigrants commit less crimes than the native born. That's just a fact.
And you determined?
We rated that mostly true. This is a topic that our national partners, PolitiFact, and Angie's team has looked at in the past as well. And we went and sort of looked at the report he was talking about. We found that that National Academy of Sciences report does back up his statement about the idea that undocumented immigrants are less likely to commit crimes, is the way we interpreted it.
Chris, that's an important fact to bring up today. One day after, we just had the confrontational meeting between the president, vice president, future Speaker of the House, and Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, where President Donald Trump mentioned that he would get behind shutting down the government in order to keep these criminals out of the country. And at least according to your fact check here, that doesn't add up. These aren't criminals coming over the border.
That's right. I mean, there are quite a few studies at this point that show that the foreign-born population is less likely to commit crimes than the native-born. The caveat here, the reason it's not a completely true statement with the rating is that researchers do agree that more data is needed to get a better understanding of immigration and crime. But I think what you brought up, Randall, about this debate that our nation saw essentially in the Oval Office yesterday about border security, the wall, immigration, the budget, it keeps this topic, this highly charged topic in the news. People want to know what the facts are when it comes to immigration. I think that undocumented immigrants and immigrants in general have been mischaracterized in some ways by some politicians, and there have been a lot of ads. We've documented the ads that have been produced by and circulated by President Trump about crimes committed by undocumented immigrants. There certainly have been crimes committed, but those ads tend to paint with a pretty broad brush. When you actually look at the facts and you look at the crime rates, they are less likely to commit crimes than the native-born population.
And we should mention the fact check you did on Villaraigosa was one of many fact checks done during the campaign for governor here in California, which I think helped inform a lot of our listeners when they eventually made it to the polls. Chris, do you have another favorite in the top 10?
Well, the other one that I wanted to talk about was the most popular fact check or article in this case, sort of an explainer article about California's legal marijuana and the laws surrounding recreational marijuana, I should say. Back about a year ago, we noticed many, many questions popping up from just the public in general about what exactly was going to be legal If you remember, January 1st was a major milestone for the state and its cannabis industry. We gained the ability to, stores gained the ability to legally sell recreational marijuana for the first time. And the questions that came up dealt with how far you could go with this, you know, at your workplace, at your home, where you could legally smoke.
There's on the still, sidewalk, right?
Right. There's still a lot of limits based on this, the California laws under Proposition 64, which governs recreational pot. So really this article attempted to answer those questions to say what you could and could not do, where you could smoke, could you travel with marijuana, what could your landlord do when it comes to limits at your apartment? And we're continuing to explore this topic because there's still a lot of questions we're looking at. We've continued to get questions from readers about sort of neighbor-to-neighbor disputes. The law allows you to smoke at your home. It's one of the only places, really, you can legally do that. But, you know, neighbors are not always happy with the what they are concerned about is secondhand smoke.
Right, the drifting, you know, clouds.
Drifting over to their homes. So, and there's the rules don't always, they're not always crystal clear about who's in the right and who's not. So we're trying to get some answers for that. We'll continue to update this article and produce new ones in the new year.
So Chris and Angie, we've discussed, what, three or four of the fact checks done through the year, but PolitiFact does many, many different fact checks throughout the year. Angie, has the pace of your work increased in recent years?
It definitely has, and I think for a couple of reasons. Number one, with President Donald Trump, we have a candidate who likes to be provocative. He likes to speak spontaneously. He doesn't seem to be concerned if he has research or evidence at his fingertips. He just kind of says what he thinks. So there's a lot more to fact check of the president. Then we have this really polarized partisanship where the intensity of the two parties competing with each other yields so many statements that need to be fact-checked. And then finally, we have social media, Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, where statements can be spread, magnified, distorted, changed. So overall, we are fact-checking at full speed these days.
Would you say that the mission of PolitiFact seems more urgent now?
It does seem more urgent, but it has essentially stayed the same. We look at facts, we do research, we consult with experts, we write up all of our findings in a transparent report so that readers can know what's accurate and what's not.
And the nice thing is all of your fact checks, if you miss them here on the radio at Cap Radio, you can find them online. And we'll tell you how to do that in just a second. National PolitiFact editor Angie Holland and PolitiFact California reporter Chris Nichols, thank you so much, both of you, for being here and the work that you do. And find the latest fact checks at PolitiFact.com, or if you want to get more specific, PolitiFact.com/California. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. You are listening to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm Randall White in for Beth Ruyak this morning. California wildfires have destroyed, really, it's a staggering number of structures, mostly homes, but many businesses, too, over the past year or so. Several of the state's most deadly, destructive, and largest wildfires on record have taken place since October of last year until just last month. And joining us today to discuss the monumental task of rebuilding these devastated communities is Dan Dunmoyer. He's the president and CEO of the California Building Industry Association. Welcome to Insight, Dan. And I want to start right off the top by addressing the number of homes that need to be rebuilt versus the number of available qualified contractors. How bad is it right now?
Randall, it's actually very bad. We need in this area of Paradise alone 14,000 single-family and multifamily residences rebuilt. And even before this fire, we have a stunning problem of finding qualified labor to build new homes. And so this complexity and this fire, this enormous fire, just adds to that challenge and will add to the delay of rebuilding this community.
Does the remote location of Paradise make the situation even more difficult to get qualified contractors to where they need to be?
It does. I mean, the major city near Paradise is Chico, and Chico now has like a rental vacancy of less than 1%.
Wow.
And so you need hundreds and thousands of skilled labor folks to build, and they would normally live in Chico. Normally live in Paradise, but now they don't have a home there. So it'll be difficult then to commute them from Chico because that's also impacted. So how far will they have to commute just to get to work in Paradise is going to add to the complexity and challenge.
Does it also make a difference that the homes being rebuilt in Paradise, for the most part, are not necessarily mansions?
That's correct. It doesn't necessarily make it more difficult. In some ways, it doesn't require the depth of skill, although to build a small home or a big home still requires plumbing, electrical, heating and air conditioning system skills, and basic framing skills. But smaller and easier homes, less expensive homes, are easier to rebuild, and that will at least assist in this effort to make it an easier process.
But might not draw the contractors in who want to make that extra money.
Correct. I mean, the challenge in trying to create a production-style building where you bring in a builder to build, let's say, 500 homes at one time is very difficult post-fire everywhere, but especially in Paradise, because Paradise does not have a history of building 1,000 homes at a time. It was homes built, in a sense, a few each year over the last 30, 40 years. So there isn't like a community like Coffee Park or others where you have 500 similar style homes in one area where you could bring in a production builder like Lennar or KB and say, hey, can you rebuild our community?
And Coffee Park is in Santa Rosa,
That's
we should
correct.
Mention, in Sonoma County.
So correct. So the Coffee Park fire there in Santa Rosa is more of a traditional track home. In Paradise, you don't have track homes that were burnt down. You have a lot of individual style homes. So finding the process to bring in a builder to build something like that is also more complicated. And that's going to be the challenge of Paradise. And it's becoming the challenge across California with these fires as well.
Yeah. And the Tubbs fire in Santa Rosa devastated large sections of town, not just the Coffee Park area.
Correct.
And in some of the areas outside of Coffee Park, we're looking at rates right now where homes are in at least some status of being rebuilt, somewhere around the 20% range. A year after the fire and the affluency of Sonoma County is higher than mm-hmm. most areas of the state, and yet we're still at just 20% a year later.
That's actually not uncommon. So my background also includes working in the insurance industry and trying to kind of adjust the claims, clear out the property, because there's a lot of toxic waste after these horrific fires. And unifying the community to create a path to do that is difficult. But you're right. The Santa Rosa City Council and the city managers have done a good job now to streamline that process. So you should see that picking up. But you're correct. After a year, you still see a small footprint being rebuilt. And because of the nature of the shortage of labor and the magnitude of these fires in California, it's going to take years to rebuild these communities.
How much of it has to do with the ability of the homeowner to pay for the contractors to come in?
It's going to change, you know, home by home. And what's interesting, it can even be the same insurance company, and yet you have an agent who persists and gets you to buy more coverage and full replacement, or you just tell your agent, which is very common, I want the cheapest possible policy,
yeah.
which means it's going to be limited coverage. So
that's common because people think it's not going to happen to me. And
exactly.
You could see that in Santa Rosa, which was not necessarily listed as a high area of vulnerability for this sort of thing.
Correct. You know, you're not in what we call the wildland urban interface. You're right. It was kind of a suburb, and it was pretty much protected by streets, roads, freeways. And once it leapt the freeway in Santa Rosa, that changed everything. But that's going to be the challenge is the insurance component. You're going to have 50 different companies and different coverages, and that's going to make it easy for some to rebuild and close to impossible for others.
So you mentioned the staggering number of homes that need to be rebuilt in the Paradise area. I did some quick math before the show to add up everything since the Tubbs fire, and there's been many, including down in Southern California, and the figure that I came up with is more than 24,000 destroyed properties, and that does include some businesses that would need to be rebuilt as well. Do those numbers match up roughly with what
they
you
do.
Know?
We say 23 to 25,000, so we're right in the same point.
Then that adds to the state of California estimates of a deficit of 3.5 million homes that need to be built in the state in order to relieve the non-wildfire-created housing crisis. Is there a way for us to bring in the necessary number of contractors that we need, even if it's from out of state?
Great question. That's the great challenge. So we agree with the numbers you provided there and feel those are accurate for both the non-fire rebuild and just the needs for the state of California. The challenge is we do have a national housing shortage and a national housing labor shortage as well. So our neighbors next to us, Nevada, Arizona, Utah, Texas, not too far away, have a tremendous demand as well. Some with, you know, in Texas's case, it's also weather-related damages. Mm. And so it's putting more pressure on the availability of labor. But the only way we are going to rebuild the needs that we have in California, both for fire-related damage and just general home building, is to attract and grow more labor in this state.
Yeah, I imagine the contractors can afford to live in California. Is it the is the shortage at the other end, the laborers who are coming onto the job sites can't necessarily afford to live in the Bay Area or wherever it may be?
Especially the Bay Area. Most contractors can't even afford to live in the Bay Area now with the average home price of $1.5 million mm-hmm. per home. But yes, if you're a laborer, you're making good money. You can make $80,000 to $100,000 a year as a plumber or electrician. But that's you can't live in San Francisco in that salary. That's considered a poverty level for a family of four in San Francisco. $116,000 is considered poverty, which anywhere else in the country, $100,000 will get you a home and a decent lifestyle. But in the Bay Area in California, there's many places where that just won't cut it.
Dan, several years ago, you worked for Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger overseeing disaster response for the state. Now you're in the home builder industry and these things are now coming together. This seems to be your moment where you really have a handle on what's going on.
And that's really the hope, because there's a lot of question about should we even rebuild? Is this the right place? And so I have sat down with some of the officials I worked with, and we can rebuild in these areas, but we have to be much more thoughtful about it. And two things that come to mind, we do have much better building codes than we had 10 years ago. They're much hardened homes, as we call them. But we also need to build the communities in such a way that there truly is defensible space surrounding these communities. And most importantly, that defensible space is maintained for years. We'll remember after this fire will be seared in our mind for about 3 to 5 years, and then we'll get lazy as Californians. If we are diligent and vigilant to maintain space around new homes that are built and all homes that exist, you know, we can mitigate the damages associated with these fires. And that requires a lot of persistence and a lot of efforts by the citizens and by the fire force itself.
Is it possible to build a fire, mostly fireproof, attractive structure that people would want to buy and live in?
It is. And that, again, assumes you maintain the defensible space. I mean, if you put high brush, you know, high dead tree, the number of dead trees around anything, even made out of stone and a roof made out of cement, it will burn. I mean, any home can burn from the inside as well, though now we have sprinklers in all homes built. So that's pretty difficult. But with defensible space, the answer is yes. Without it, there's pretty much no home you can build that's not going to eventually burn, because the power of these fires is just stunning.
It really is. We're speaking with the president and CEO of the California Building Industry Association, Dan Dunmoyer. Dan, at this same time when we have this shortage, some people who have lost their properties may feel like they lucked out. Wow, I found a contractor who's willing to do the work, and it turns out to be a scam. Mm-hmm. How do you weed through that at a time when you're very vulnerable?
Great question. We see this, again, from my insurance background. We would see people come in and say, hey, you know, if you want me to build your home first, you have to give me a lot of money now, and then I'll build it. And then they end up in a foreign country living on a beach. So, I mean, there's a couple of key things. One, make sure they're licensed. Two, you can go onto the websites of the California public policy and government and find out if they really truly are licensed. I mean, they should have a track record. A good home builder has built, even if they're a custom home builder who builds 10 homes a year, that means they've built hundreds of homes. And so ask them to go see the homes, talk to the family that lives in those homes, and see if that home builder is real.
And nobody should ever ask for more than 10% down, so to speak, for building a home. You know, as a builder, you can't spend that much money that quickly. You can't buy the cement and the wood and other things. So somebody says, well, I need 50% of your insurance proceeds. They're probably a crook.
Dan, if you had magical powers and you could change anything you want right now to get these homes built as quickly as possible so people can return home and rebuild their communities, what would you change?
Well, a couple of things. One, local governments need to create a process for rebuilding that's easier. And Santa Rosa is a great example where the city leaders came together and created expedited permits, expedited review process, and brought people together as a community. That's what changes the time to rebuild. And we've seen that in California and in my national background before. We saw that in other communities. Communities that come together and cities that come together change things. The second thing is to attract labor and to allow for short-term communities to be built. You'll hear efforts in Chico and other parts to bring in literally RVs or mobile homes to bring in the labor and to make sure they can live close by so they don't spend 2-3 hours commuting, and that's a wasted time to rebuild. So if communities can assist and support in that transitional housing until it can be rebuilt, that would help. And the final thing, too, is also for the state and local leaders to come together and develop a strategy to harden those areas to make sure that these fires don't occur again. And that can be done. It's done in other communities throughout the state. It just requires that focus of attention.
Dan, I wish we had more time. I could speak to you for a full hour on this topic, but we're glad we had you while we did. Dan Dunmoyer, president and CEO of the California Building Industry Association, discussing the challenges of rebuilding after a year or so of absolutely devastating wildfires statewide. Thanks for being on Insight.
Randall, thanks for having me.
And we have more at capradio.org/insight. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio.
Nobody knows where the shadows go into the night, soft as a whisper. I think they climb to the sky.
You're listening to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm Randall White in today for Beth Rieck. The way human beings learn language from each other is a rich and complicated field of science. The assumptions and myths that older generations grew up with are being challenged and overturned by new research. Joining us today is Dr. Kathy Hirsch-Pasek. She's the author of a dozen books on the subject, so I think she might know what she's talking about. including Becoming Brilliant, What Science Tells Us About Raising Successful Children, and Einstein Never Used Flashcards, How Our Children Really Learn and Why They Need to Play More and Memorize Less. Today, Dr. Hirsch-Pasek will present a lecture, which is free and open to the public, at the UC Davis Mind Institute in Sacramento. Dr. Pasek, welcome to Insight.
Thank you so much.
So your presentation today will go over 6 core principles of learning language. Let's go over them briefly, and then we can discuss them a bit more. So children learn the words they hear the most, and that,
I know.
That may be concerning for some parents.
You're all going, duh.
Right.
Listen, one year I got a call, I think it was from Redbook, and they said, oh my gosh, our children are using more profanity. I said, well, you know, they learn what they hear the most.
It's what they're hearing in the household, right?
But yeah. but it actually is more profound than you think. It really lets us know that our kids are tuned into us at a very early age.
Maybe before they're even speaking?
Even before they're speaking. In fact, would you believe that there's some data that they're listening in when they're in the womb,
right,
for those last 2 months? Now, they got the ba-boom of the heartbeat underneath, and they have the swish of the amniotic fluid. But if you put that aside, those kids are hearing the kind of sounds of language. And when they get out, just 2 days after they get out, we can actually find a test to find out if they recognize mom's voice. And they do. And they recognize the language that they'll end up speaking later.
So your advice, clean it up early?
Clean it up early. No, it just shows us that our children are much more attuned than sometimes we give them credit for. Now, what I'm not saying is to go buy the pregaphone or to insert something so that your baby can hear it better than the swoosh and the boom-boom in the background.
All right.
Not necessary. It's just that our children are attuned and they're way smarter than we ever gave them credit for.
Another point you make here is social interaction matters.
Yeah, Yeah, that may be the absolute key point. So I'm going to make it in two ways for you. One is that that back and forth conversation that we can have with little babies, believe it or not, even when they're 8 to 10 weeks of age, 8 to 10 weeks, if it's a coo or a burp, having those conversations matters. It's what we call in the business contingency, that my language is responsive and sensitive to what the baby says and does. But I'll add that we're breaking that a lot in today's world because we're often picking up that cell phone, looking down at our texts, and so we're not quite as responsive as we used to be as parents. So advice? Take 2 minutes a day, put the cell phone away, and look into the eyes of your baby.
Doctor, I read an article the other day that using baby talk with your pets is beneficial, that it actually does work with the pets. How about with your baby? Is baby talk something we should be doing?
Well, there really is some evidence on that. It turns out that when we use what we call child-directed speech or baby talk, we do a couple things that are interesting. We slow down the language a little bit. It's a little bit shorter in the sentences that we produce, and we elongate the vowels a little bit. And all that seems to be helpful. However, it turns out that while there's some form of child-directed speech in every language around the world, it differs a little bit. And that sing-songy thing we use in English in the United States, that's probably the most extreme version we have out there.
Is that right? Can you give us an example of another country, how you might hear baby talk?
Well, I'm not so good at doing those imitations, and people might tease me for what I do. But the British are much more subdued, and so is their, you know, infant-directed speech.
Yeah.
So, you know, there are different modifications that we make, but in all cases, it's kind of like having a megaphone. And it helps the babies hear just what they need to hear. Notice again, it's back to that social interaction. The I care about what you're looking at. I'm going to look at it too and then comment on it. And this is as true for children who may end up with autism as those who do not. Every child benefits from having a parent care, look into where they're looking, and labeling what they're looking at. It's just good practice.
It's also really hard to use baby talk and be negative.
That's true. There is, believe it or not, a study on that where one of my colleagues decided to have a really harsh voice when she was using something like baby talk. And you can see the babies, if you say something yucky and it's in a happy tone, they smile. And if you say something happy and it's in a yucky tone, they get ready to cry.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting. Okay, so children learn words for events and things that interest them.
Right. Now, we've already touched on that, and that is what we'll call follow in, don't lead. As parents, so often we want our children to notice what we notice, and we get all excited about it. And there we are taking a walk down the street, and our kid notices the slug that's under the rock. Blech! We could care less. Redirect. No, talk about the slug.
Yeah.
So wherever our kids show an interest, we should try to follow in on that. And it turns out that if we do, all the research shows us that our children will actually learn more words and learn more language.
It's interesting because social cues, I think, do train us as we grow up that insects and bugs are gross and icky. But as kids, we're like, check this out.
Yeah, not bad, huh?
Children learn words best in meaningful contexts.
Right. And that's what we had just talked about. When it's something they really like, they're interested in, and it's meaningful to them, they're more likely to learn it. Now, I will admit, I'm the same way. If you give me a lecture on something I care about, I'm going to walk out having learned something. And if you try to teach me about all the stuff I don't care about, it just doesn't work as well. Now, look, we do have to go through school and go through life, and we do have to master things that we could care less about. But we could at least start by doing those meaningful things like playing with blocks And our children really learn a lot in those environments. Let me just give you an example. One of the more important things for being math ready in school is actually using spatial language and math language. Where do we use that? Well, believe it or not, when we're playing with blocks, we talk about putting the red block on top of the green block, next to, around, in, through. We're using spatial language, and that predicts a large portion of how our children will do in math just a few years later.
Wow. We're speaking with Dr. Kathy Hirsch-Pasek. She's an expert on how children learn language, and you can see her this afternoon at the Mind Institute. Doctor, we have one more core principle to get to, and that is vocabulary and grammar development are reciprocal processes. Explain that.
Right, I will. That sounds like a lot of academic gobbledygook, and right. I'm going to unpack it for you. A lot of times we think that it's all about just dumping words into the empty mind of a child. And so we think it's something like learning our SAT or GRE words. And that couldn't be farther from the truth. We learn vocabulary while we're learning to talk, while we're having conversations. And the most important thing we can do is have conversations with our children, with our teachers. If we have more discussion, our children learn more. And unfortunately, today, many of those conversations are lacking. They're lacking because we're each on our separate little cell phone devices, or we're in a classroom and we're being taught at rather than being taught with, which is not the way in which we learn. So we got to step it up. We got to languageize our environments and languageize our schools. That means having more conversations and not just drilling in words.
You mentioned phones and tablets and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
How do you feel about apps that are aimed at children's language learning?
Well, you know, I'm all for technology if it's the right technology. But I think in many cases we overdo. And what we do is we see that our kids like it, and we go, wow, we're going to let our kids do whatever they want because they
love it. This is an easy fix
it.
For the situation.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And by the way, it is easy, you know? We pass over the phone, they're quiet at the restaurant. I mean, really? Not bad. Good babysitter. At the same time, we don't feel the same way about just serving people dessert. So they like that too. And I got to tell you, I would pick chocolate cake over green beans any day. But you're not going to let me eat chocolate cake all day. So everything has to be in balance. What makes a good app? I'm just going to give you a tweet for it. When it's something that allow our children to be active rather than passive, engaged rather than distractive, when it's meaningful rather than disjointed, when it's socially interactive, it prompts people to have those conversations, and it has a kind of goal to it, then it's probably a good app. But those apps that just kind of scream at you, nix. And they're certainly not educational.
So apps, of course, the big thing to talk about now. Television has been in the conversation for years.
Right.
What about using a television or television shows to help children learn?
Well, I think, again, and it's the same thing we learned in the research on television shows, we find that parents don't hang around a co-view, which is what allows us to have those conversations. So that kind of doesn't work. And some shows are better than other shows. So you have shows that are out there that are absolutely fabulous.
Like a Sesame Street?
Sesame Street is a known quantity. The Blue's Clues, the Tumbleleaf. There are a lot of fabulous shows out there. Watch the good ones. How do you know whether they're good ones or not? Common Sense Media puts out a lovely guide. And if you look there, you'll know what apps are largely the best apps, and you'll also get a sense of what are the best shows.
What are some of the common myths and misunderstandings that we grew up with but have since been disproven by science?
I think the biggest misunderstanding is that we should be CEOs and that our kids are there to just take in everything we teach them. Really, it's more of a back and forth. Children learn when they're active learners. Brains grow when children are active explorers and discoverers. They are very far from empty vessels. So the very best advice that we give as psychologists and scientists is to help those brains grow by having those conversations and allowing our kids to be the explorers and discoverers that they are.
Is there evidence to show whether a bilingual household is more beneficial to language learning or not?
There's a lot of evidence out there. And the answer is that being bilingual is a real plus. In fact, it's almost a shame that we aren't all bilingual. We should be. Having two languages has wonderful payoffs for us. Among them is that we have better executive function skills, which is attention and memory, problem solving, flexibility of mind. We have better self-control because you have to learn to inhibit one language while you're using the other language. Now, children who are growing up in a bilingual home, they generally will have their first words just a very pinch later and maybe put words together a pinch later, but the advantages far outweigh any of the negatives. Plus, a big plus, you're less likely to have Alzheimer's when you grow up.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
One language helps you learn the other language, your own language, sometimes your native language. You learn better when you learn another language.
Well, I think we are just wonderful at learning languages. One of my colleagues says that humans learn language in the way that spiders spin webs. Isn't it beautiful? And we really do. And we know that a lot of children can learn 2 and 3 and 4. The majority of the world is at least bilingual. So it's just putting the machinery, you know, into high drive, and it does a great job in high drive.
Why does it get so much more difficult as you get older?
Well, in part, it's because our ways get set like they do with anything else. This happened to my tennis serve as well. You know, I mean, oh my gosh, it's hard to change it and make it good as opposed to yucky, but the way it is. You know, the brain has a certain critical periods. It's not a close-off, but it means that it's more sensitive to certain information at certain points in time. And language is one of the golden cases for the critical period or sensitive period hypothesis. It turns out that after around age 8, if you move to another country, you'll still have an accent. And the younger, the better for being exposed to those multiple languages. One more point on that, which is, what's the best way to help groom a bilingual child? One parent speaks one language, the other parent speaks the other, or in-home language, out-of-home language. Try not to mix it up too much from the same parent, because if you do that, you can get it all together.
A lot of mashing it up, right?
Yeah.
What is the cutting edge of language science? What's the unanswered question that you and your colleagues are working on now?
There are so many unanswered questions, to be honest. How is it that this synchrony between mom and kid helps us to learn words? Is there something going on where we kind of share a moment in our brains when we are doing this back and forth language dance? Actually, a lot of people think that's exactly what's going on, and that there's then going to be a sweet spot for how you learn words and how you learn language. What about bilingualism? How's it working? Are those two languages kept separate, or are those two languages somehow closely harbored in the same mental house? We're starting to get information on that. We don't absolutely know. We know a lot about language development. Can we use it? Can we help apply these lessons to children who are not typically developing and help each of them raise the potential? Right here at the Mind Institute, you have researchers who have broken through to show us that children who are born with autism can be in the normal curve in their language development. All children, some 90%, will get there if we have the right kind of early interventions. And the science teaches us what those early interventions are. So your homegrown work is part of the frontiers of the science that we're creating every day.
There's also science to show, is there not, that when you're thinking in a different language,
mm-hmm.
you interact with the world differently. You think about problem solving differently. Like it's not just saying different words. It's a whole different way of thinking.
Well, I just finished a paper on that. So I'll just give you the paper that I sent back this morning. There's a yes and a no to that. It's not as if I can't communicate perfectly well with somebody from France or someone from China and get them to understand what's in my head. So in that sense, all human minds share a way of communicating and a way of thinking and a way of representing. On the other hand, it is absolutely the case that different languages highlight different things. So let's take probably the two most prominent languages around here, which would be Spanish and English.
Right.
Wouldn't you know that in the Spanish verb system, and I bet you very few people know this, you're more likely to talk about the path, where you're going, than about how you're moving. That's what gets coded into the verb system. So we talk about into, we talk about alongside, we talk about the path at which someone is going. Now, in English, we have 22 times more what we call manner verbs, or how you're moving, that you're jumping, that you're running, that you're skipping, that you're hopping. So in Spanish, the English equivalent would be something like, I'm moving into the house hoppingly, okay? Whereas in English, we say I'm hopping and put the into outside the verb in a preposition into the house. Now, who notices that, right? But it turns out that our kids do. And it turns out that when they are hearing Spanish and English, they're primed just a little bit more to look at the path, where it's going in Spanish, and to the manner, how you're moving in English.
Fascinating stuff. So terrific to have you here, Dr. Kathy Hirsch-Pasek. She's an expert on how children learn language and so many other aspects of language. Thank you again for being on Insight.
You bet. It's been a total pleasure.
You're listening to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm Randall White in for Beth Ruyak. If you've ever seen Sacramento's very own Peter Petty perform live, you know he isn't just a musician. He's an entertainer. The band leader is showcasing his talents this weekend during his annual holiday show. We caught up with him yesterday to talk about Son of Hepcat's Holiday Swingin' Yuletide Review.
Very often it's a matter of just hearing tunes that you like and you would like to cover as well. And yep, that's pretty much how I populated the list. And also you get a little saturated with the same versions of the same songs again and again. It's just not as compelling or as interesting. And most of my stuff is pretty well swing-based. And I have a real affinity for just early swing, like 20s through the 40s, let's say, which is a pretty wide span. But there's just some great hidden gems that nobody's heard, and they swing so hard you can't help but dance to them.
The last thing you could call this song list is tired.
It ain't tired yet. No, no.
No, it's not. And in fact, let's hear a little. Let's start with Is That You, Santa Claus?
It might be.
Gifts I'm preparing for some Christmas chattering, but I pause because hanging my stocking, I can hear a knocking. Oh, it sure is dark out. Ain't the slightest spark out. Pardon my clacking jaws. Yeah, who's there? Who is it? You stopping for a visit? Is that you, Santa Claus?
So the music really lends to wanting to dance.
Yeah.
And it'll be okay for people to dance at this venue?
Well, last year, we actually sold out the room to the degree that it was just shoulder-to-shoulder standing room only, and the dance floor that I had promised was just filled.
Was filled.
So there was no dance floor last year, and that's an important thing. A lot of people, pettifiles, I call them. A lot of my pettifiles are swing dancers. So that's a bitter disappointment indeed when you get, there's just no room to dance. Show was still fantastic, but there were actually two women last year who demanded their money back because they were expecting
to dance.
Because
they couldn't dance.
That's right. So we don't want to return to that kind of unpleasantness. Certainly not the holiday season.
Nor have to return any money.
yeah, that's okay. You're thinking on my wavelength. Nonetheless, so we just had to get a bigger room this year, and there is a dedicated big old dance floor. So there is dancing.
Yeah, the Elks Tower Ballroom is a terrific space.
Ah, just beautiful.
How does the space play into your energy when you're putting on one of these shows?
Well, when you get in there, it almost is like a match made in, somewhere, I suppose. But no, it's the perfect room for a show like this, for a Peter Petty show, especially. It's just perfect because it's era-specific. The place built in the 1920s, and it is just grand and grandiose. It's a beautifully appointed room. It's perfect. And they got that floating wooden floor, so it's just perfect for everything we're doing.
Peter, you are larger than life. How did Peter become Peter Petty?
Well, it is the name assigned to me by my parents, the alliteration twins, they like to go by. it's funny. I get this question a lot, and I still don't think I have the correct response for it that really encapsulates it easily. Already I'm going far afield. But I grew up listening to a lot of this music, and my parents were married in 56, so they were kind of right smack dab in the middle of the swing era coming up. And so lots of Hollywood musicals and movies and songs, and the whole family was always singing and sharing that with each other. And so it's just kind of set in my noggin. And then, you know, popular music of the day is also there and everything. But when I started to express myself musically, I think I just had a natural inclination to sort of interpret songs sort of like what I had been hearing all these years, and that sort of the vocal stylings of the more swinging interpretations of songs. And then in the early 90s, when the big neo-swing movement hit, I was fronting a swing band. And so it just kind of glommed on. It's kind of natural to me, I think.
It feels so natural to you. Do you ever feel out of sync with modern culture when it comes to what people are listening to and that sort of thing? Or do you feel more of a drive to get people on board with what's really, you know, floating your boat?
Well, Randall, yes and yes. No, I mean, a lot of just straight pop music doesn't interest me that much. But there is so much exciting things going on now musically, especially with the ubiquity of hip hop and how it's just influencing everything. And it's maturing, I think, to a degree, too, where it is extremely interesting and compelling what they're doing now and what they're saying. Everything's always adapting and everything. But that's something that I'd like to do, actually. In fact, I call my brand of music what I do hip hop for obvious reasons. The hep, you know, being the hep cat daddy kind of stuff. But then because it's not a staid program, I really go, like my motto is, there's no small rooms. You know, I just can't contain it. And so we bring a lot of that that life to it. One thing I love about swing, and as I've become more educated about it, swing music was the hip hop of its day.
Right.
You know? Mm-hmm. And so young people were going out to clubs precisely for the reason that I think they go out to see hip hop shows today. It's exciting, it's vibrant, and it's a little dangerous. I mean, somebody back in the day, you know, was going to come home drunk, high, or pregnant, maybe even all three, you know? So it was what young people were drawn to. And plus, you were dancing. I mean, you can't divorce the sexuality from it, you know?
Is Saturday's show a little dangerous?
Oh, yes, indeed. That's why it's for 21 plus. So it's not for the kiddies. So we have burlesque coming. We have, let's see, what is it? What does the sign say? Rated R for brief nudity, language, and alcohol. Right, so there will be a little. It's a little something for daddy.
And, you know, and a little something that people will hear at the event on Saturday is this song, Merry Christmas, Baby.
Oh, yeah.
Well, Merry Christmas, Baby. You sure did treat me nice. Now!
When people go out to a show, they're going out to be entertained. You're a musician and an entertainer. Where do you see yourself more, as the musician or the entertainer?
Certainly not the musician end things, no. My business card says personality, because that really is the only thing that's accurate enough explain what I'm doing. I continue to educate myself and become far more educated, musically speaking. When I first started leading my own band, I was every, you know, jazz musician's worst nightmare, a vocalist who wants to lead a band, right? But each and every one of these men and women are my mentors. I look at them that way because they're all vets and they know what they're doing. And I have learned what I am doing as well in the last 5 years and in previous. You know, I sang with Sacramento Opera for 8 years prior to that. And so I'm not a complete idiot, but I don't have really a formal education, as it were. So
now, depending on the gig, people might see you in, as it says here, a full tuxedo tails, a purple wig, or even a Santa suit. Now, I assume they're going to see the Santa suit on Saturday. Might they see the others?
I believe they're going to see variations of all three of those descriptions and so much more, Randall. So much more.
Excellent. Let's close out this segment with another song from the show, Boogie Woogie Santa Claus.
Oh, well, look ahead, Jack, shuffling down the track. He got a rhythm in his feet, but nothing in his sand. The boogie woogie Santa Claus. The boogie woogie Santa Claus.
Peter Petty is the 2018 recipient of the Sacramento Area Music Award in the category of Best Live Performer. His annual holiday show, Son of Hepcats Holiday Swinging Yuletide Review, is this Saturday at the Elks Tower Ballroom. Doors open at 8 o'clock. More information can be found at capradio.org/insight. And that is Insight for today. I'm Randall White. Insight produced by Jen Picard, Burt Johnson, and Cody Drabble. Our digital team is Chris Hagen, Casey Gardner, and Emily Zentner. Today's engineer, Anthony Van Hook. Technical director is Mark Jones. Insight's executive producer is Joe Barr. And we're back with another live show tomorrow. Thanks for joining us.